what you got before by way of pics was four shots of the forum, really. Shots mostly, well, shots of the big plenary. That's the one where you look around the room and you can practically see the mist in the distance. There seem to be so many people in the room. Or of the small group, which was around, you know, we would end up with around 30 people in the room. And there were also some shots of us going around the country talking to people, which we did in a format which in a way was not unlike this one, although it had some interesting differences. So let me come to my second installment, and let me just say again, I'm not here to give a blueprint, but I am here to report on experience. And thinking about experience leads me to say that although we were the first people to use a collaborative model at the national level on a complex issue or set of issues, and although I think it's very important that the Scandinavian experience, which Guy reported on, gave us a sense of possibility, there is, and pace Guy, quite a rich heritage of collaborative experience in New Zealand. Now, I thought Guy made a quite excellent point when he said not all of them is bridging social capital, a lot of them are bonding social capital, and to some extent that may be true. But they're not all the same, and bridging or bonding, I think they're all extremely helpful. So I'd just like to remind ourselves that not only, of course, is there the Canterbury Water Management Scheme, which is an attempt to institutionalise collaboration on a regional scale, but also in Tasman, which, if you go there, is a place where everybody kind of knows about collaboration or is involved in it. In Tasman, there's the Waimea Water Augmentation Project, which involves, and this is a very interesting point, it involves the Tasman District Council. The Tasman District Council was central to its being set up, but the people calling the shots are the Waimea Water Augmentation Committee. They take the lead. And that is quite complex, and it deals with storage, shortages, irrigation, power generation, over allocation, and it deals with rural and local issues, and it has a full cast of players. So it's a very interesting, other thing that's been going on here. And it's also worth bearing in mind the New Zealand Landcare Trust, which has just recently had its funding increased, and that's a sign, I think, of its success, which has germinated a number of collaborative ventures, some of which are just within communities, although very interestingly so. The Aurere involved a community of dairy farmers who had to realise that the action of their cows was preventing the mussel farmers out in the bay from ever being able to harvest their mussels. And the farmers, as Sue Brown, who ran it, said, took responsibility for the environmental performance of their farms. But also, another really interesting example is in the Upper Tairi in central Otago, where a group of farmers who had water for dryland farming as a result of old mining leases. They had what is known in the trade as derived rights, which are measured in spades. These guys realised, they came to a realisation which at first they were inclined to question, but they found they couldn't, that these rights would expire and there was nothing they could do about it. And they got together, led by a prescient man called Jeff Crutchley and assisted by Gretchen Robertson from the New Zealand Landcare Trust. They got together and they designed a way through. They designed a way which, and they involved other players, including Fish and Game, in this process. And beyond these things which are community or region-based, there are also quite a lot of industry schemes. And I don't think even where we don't think that they're enough, even where we think they've fallen short, I don't think we should ignore their presence, because they too are growing points which all of us who are involved in this set of issues would want to nurture. And they include the Primary Sector Water Partnership, they include the Clean Streams Accord, which is coming up for Mark 2, and they also include, and this is another really interesting thing, they also include, after or even during the forum, the involvement of a wider range of players by industry in their own planning. So Fish and Game has been involved by the dairy industry and by Zespri in doing some of its regional planning. So the dairy industry has been working on how it might collaborate better with the green NGOs. It seems to me that this is actually social capital in action. And some actual initiatives have been encouraged, I'd say, by the forum, including the Manawatu River Leaders Forum, which I sort of helped to start, but I had to abandon because the forum was taking all my time.
Are we going to answer some questions?
Yes. Well, you'd probably break Alistair in mid-stride, so maybe wait till the end, unless it's particularly poignant.
Wait. I'll come back to you. And finally, the Mackenzie River Basin. The Mackenzie Basin, which Guy, I think, will be talking about in a few minutes. So there's a big range of experience we all have to draw on. And but when I think about it from my narrow perspective, I do want to report that when you do these things, the experience is anything but theoretical. Which leads me to tell you what the first four questions are when you're running a forum at all, like the Land and Water Forum, and I felt exactly the same thing when I was initially chairing the Manawatu one. The first question for the first day is, how do you get them to come back on day two? And the question for day two is, how do you get them to come back on day three? And the question on day three and the question on day four, they are exactly the same. And why is that? That is because all the people whom you would want sitting around your table, all these people who have in some sense the power to commit their organisations, and if they don't, they're no use to you. All of these people have other things to do with their time. And they also have other things that they can spend their money on. And also, it can take quite a while for a large and disparate body of people to come to own a process and to think that it's their responsibility to make sure that it continues to run and not the chair's or someone else's. So, I thought I just might say quite briefly a few of the things that we had to do to make sure that people came back the next day and that we didn't have the dread experience of seeing our numbers dwindle and the most powerful being the first to leave. So the first requirement, I think, was to let people have an engaging conversation. Let them sit around the table and go around the table and let them say things which would allow them to feel their disagreements, but without a loss of the civility which was required to let them help to bridge them. And also a conversation in which they heard something interesting. And if I cast my mind back to that first day, before the forum even really started, when the small group met for the first time and we were trying to work out, we had this good idea, but what was it exactly that we were going to do, and how was it that we might conceivably do it. On that first day, when we went round the table, there was this big, tall man whom I had never met before called Dean Stebbing, who came from Ngāti Tuwharetoa. And he was sitting, as he normally sat, it turned out, halfway round the table. And when it got to Dean, he said that he was speaking on behalf of Ngāti Tuwharetoa. He explained why he couldn't speak on behalf of other iwi. But he also explained to us why, if we thought that iwi were green creatures who were going to be solely preoccupied with kaitiakitanga defined in a certain Pākehā way, then we had another think coming. Because he reminded us that Ngāti Tuwharetoa had the biggest private forests in New Zealand, that they had huge quantities of undeveloped land, and that they owned a lake, and that they had shares in some pretty big power stations. And it disturbed everybody. It changed the equilibrium. And I think that we kind of picked up on that a bit when we went and had, once we actually formally got underway, that was the meeting I'm talking about happened in January, when we had our first meeting on the 15th of August that year, we went to Taupo. And at the Taupo hui, we heard not only from Ngāti Tuwharetoa, but from the other iwi who were with us, including Whanganui, and Nancy Tuaine's account of what had happened on the Whanganui. Knocked your socks off, and not with pleasure. It was not a good, it's not a happy story. And that kind of moved everybody also into a different space from the one that they might have expected to be in. So, an interesting, engaging conversation. Another thing is, you actually do need something to agree about. And there's my exhibit one. This is called Land and Water Forum, A Fresh Start for Fresh Water, Protocols for Participation. It started before we were the Land and Water Forum. It started when we were still the Sustainable Land Use Forum, but it was a draft which I put on the table on day two. I promised it on day one, and I put it on the table on day two, and it evolved after that. And it consisted of a set of rules for engagement. Courtesy. We deal with contentious issues, taken strong positions based on advocacy roles, fundamental that we'll be open-minded, treat each other with courtesy, and so on and so on. And good faith. We won't all go back on what we've said. And confidentiality. We felt if we were negotiating in public, it would... I didn't ever use the word negotiating. If we were collaborating in public, it'd be dead, because it would force people to take positions which were a lot harder than the positions which they would take if they were sitting around the table. We couldn't respect one another's frankness if we were doing it in the open air. Urgency described the way in which the processes would run, including the consensus rule. It described the way in which government would participate, and it said all these protocols and processes are open to review. But getting that agreed got some water under our keel. It got a run on the board. It started it ticking over. As well as that, it became clear to me as we went along, and quite quickly, we needed a cunning plan. Because in the end, people will only go on doing this if they feel that they're embarked on a task which is in some sense tractable. They have to be able to manage it, and they have to have a sense of how. So we produced a document which was called A Fresh Start for Fresh Water, though a lot of documents are called that, and which said, in essence, this is going to be a two-part process. And it said the first part of this process is going to be given over to understanding one another's businesses. We need to know what businesses we're in and what strategies we're following in these businesses, especially in relation to water. We need to be informed by one another about where water use is heading in this country. And the second part, which is when we come down to resolve a series of problems, which I briefly articulated in this document, the second part will be built on the knowledge which we've amassed in the first part. And the first part, of course, was a way in which people, it was a forcing ground for getting people to know one another, not just personally, but also in terms of the institutional background that everybody essentially brought into the room. And I just want to say one other thing about that first part, because it was very important. We actually had Colin James, who was facilitating that first set of conversations. And at the end of it, like a magician with a hat, he produced a very wonderful rabbit. And his very wonderful rabbit, which we hadn't asked him for, was a piece of paper which essentially said, water is a huge opportunity for New Zealand. But to keep it that way, we have to make sure that it is an opportunity for all and not just for some of us. And he articulated in very, very down-to-earth terms the reasons for which people like it. That it's a taonga for iwi, that it's what we drink to stay alive, that we love it for recreation or for contemplation. And also that it is essential for a whole series of economic uses, whether they're manufacturing or farming or forestry and so on and so on and so on and so on. And all of these things have to be done in such a way as to maximise the opportunities that we all have and not to undercut them. And I think that was the first sort of, I'm not telling it to you sufficiently eloquently for you to, I would have to have the document with me for you to understand its force. But I think Guy and Glenn will agree, people simply agreed and they made it absolutely clear that they agreed, and it gave us a huge basis for going forward into the second phase. We also needed an agenda, and I wrote an agenda called Issues for Part 2. I'm not going to talk about it much. I don't think it was... We needed it. It kind of worked, and it did, but we needed to give structure to the discussions that we got to after November, once we'd been through the preliminaries and understood where we were all coming from and what it was that we were talking of. And finally, and this is the last thing I'm going to say, the straw man. I mentioned a straw man before. One day, Fraser Winneray, who was the person from Mighty River Power, said to me while we were having a coffee, because much of what happened in the Land and Water Forum went on outside the Land and Water Forum, a relatively small amount of it went on in the room. Fraser said to me over a coffee, "Have you got a straw man?" And I thought, no, but I need one. So I went away and wrote one. And what a straw man consists of, this is the first one, and you can see, was pretty damn short. What it consists of is, it begins with a sentence, Land and Water Forum consensus might include the following elements. And then it describes, it sets them out in very broad terms. And this straw man spawned other straw men, or straw persons, or whatever we want to call them, as it became possible to elaborate more. And it was useful in two ways. One was showing it privily to various people in the forum and saying something like this. But the other, as I got bolder, was starting to say it in public, so that to groups of, say, dairy industry leaders or groups of foresters or to iwi leaders, it was possible to start saying, without making much of it, to feed into their thought that this was a possible outcome that the forum might have. And in that sense, to express a direction and to build confidence and to keep a running check that we weren't somewhere where a critical person would be completely unable to follow. So, I don't have any conclusions to draw from this, but there are some snippets. And I don't know what I have to do about that question, Glenn, but I'm very conscious of its existence. Shoot.
Alistair, I got intrigued by a comment you made about farmers, I think it was in Tasman or somewhere else, becoming aware of the effluent in the water having an effect on mussel farms, which started me thinking about altruism and collaborative work. And I wondered, what your thoughts are on what you saw around altruism in the collaborative process. Is this actually going?
That's great.
Oh, yeah, okay. Before I let you talk, I just want to say that. When you made the comment about Colin James' rabbit, I thought that was an excellent rabbit that really probably provoked altruism. I mean, you talked about him saying the opportunity that around water for all, not just for some. And what I'm wondering is, what are your thoughts about a collaborative approach and altruism?
I think we're complex beasts, and I think we like to agree. I think that's one of our social instincts, is to agree with one another. I think there are some other social instincts as well. And I think people who are engaged in a collaborative process, like the one I was involved with, are there not just as individuals. They're there as representatives, in some sense, of conglomerations of individuals, whether these are expressed as NGOs or as industry associations or as corporations. And so it's not just a question of what they personally feel, although I would never want to say that what they personally felt was not an important element in the equation. I think part of it has to do with a calculation about what is in the best interests of the interests that you represent. And I think what we would have wanted to do was to encourage people to take long-term views, intergenerational, as Iwi kept on reminding us, intergenerational views about the nature of those interests. So I think I agree with you, altruism is important, but I think that to get to it, you have to manage a lot of very concrete-ish interests. You have to manage people's unhappiness, for example, farmers' unhappiness, that they seem somehow to be going on doing what they've always done. They seem somehow to being blamed by everyone, and it enrages them. You have to deal with foresters' sense that the rain which falls on their forests oughtn't to be taken into account in accounting for the flows in rivers. You have to deal, there are a lot of people who, and I'm not wishing to say that they're right or wrong about this, I'm just wanting to say that there are a lot of ways to see the world, and you have to not, I'm now wanting to move away from you a little, you have to not make a series of moral judgments about the positions people are taking. I think that gives me a bob each way.
So you have to manage the emotions as well as the content.
Yes, you do.